Heads up, like all good interviews, this one has a lot of swearing.
From Wondery, I'm Brooke Ziffrin.
And I'm Arisha Skidmore-Williams.
And this is Even the Rich. Over the last four episodes, we've been revisiting our series on Diana and Meghan. And I gotta say, I'd forgotten how sad the whole saga was.
Yeah, I built this whole tiara closet for nothing.
You mean you didn't already have a tiara closet? How bizarre. I, on the other hand, have ample space for my non-existent jewels.
Isn't playing make-believe the best?
Make-believe is definitely better than thinking you've found your fairy tale, only to have it turn into a nightmare. A lot of the story of Diana's tragically short life is really just about unrealistic expectations.
First comes love, then comes marriage, then comes a horrifying tabloid disaster.
Ugh, I know, right? But believe it or not, even on the second time around, we still didn't manage to fit in every juicy detail of Princess Diana's life. There are a lot of lingering questions and surprising details we had to leave on the cutting room floor. Luckily, we now have the chance to dig into some of them with none other than Michael Hobbs. Michael is a senior reporter at HuffPost. He's also one of the hosts of the podcast You're Wrong About, which recently wrapped its own fantastic series about Princess Diana. Michael's research for that show led him to some very interesting conclusions about the role of the royal family.
But don't worry, we're going to ask him the big questions too.
Right, like what was up with that revenge dress?
And what he thinks about the crown.
And does he worry about Prince Charles' posture too?
Ugh, this is going to be so much fun.
Hey, Michael, thank you so much for joining us today. We're really excited to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get started, can you just explain the premise of your show, You're Wrong About, to our listeners?
Yes. Luckily, we have a very descriptive title. It's basically all the stories that sort of in the back of your mind, you think you know them. You're like, oh, I think I remember something about Amy Fisher. Like, wasn't she the worst? And like, she killed a bunch of people. And then we go back and we're like, actually, what you remember is kind of constructed from bad media representations and not from her own actual experiences. And then we go back and we're like, what actually happened here? And is Amy Fisher the worst? Or is she potentially like a misunderstood person who did something really dumb, but also was like a human being in the midst of a complicated situation? So that's just one example. But I mean, we sort of wish that there weren't so many stories that we could include in our show. But it turns out a lot of historical events are not widely understood and we have to go back and retell them.
Yeah. You've also tackled a lot of serious topics on You're Wrong About. The Tuskegee syphilis study, human trafficking, Stonewall. Why did you decide to take on the story of Diana?
I mean, this was basically just like me in the middle of quarantine. And I, you know, I'm a reporter for HuffPost. I often cover like child sex trafficking and QAnon. And it was just like a huge bummer. And I just thought I just need something like light and easy. You know, no eating disorders, no suicide attempts, something light. And then I picked Diana and I started reading. And of course, it's like a much more serious story than I thought it was. But I think it's nice to tell these human stories that have their complications, but like within the parameters of like, it's not as bad as the real world right now. And that was, it basically came about because of my own human frailty and I wanted to do something frivolous.
Yeah. Now, in a lot of ways, Diana is seen as something of a secular saint, but You're Wrong About really tries to demonstrate that she was, you know, just a person dealing with an impossible situation. And like you just mentioned, we touched on Diana's eating disorder on Even the Rich, but we didn't spend much time on her mental health struggles, and that's something that you address at length on your show. Why do you think that information is critical for audiences to have as part of how we understand her now?
I mean, I think that we all like complex stories, and we like stories of humanity, and what makes people people are their faults, and are the difficulties that they have, and the things that they overcome. And there's something very sort of interestingly fish out of water of Diana being like a relatively normal person, at least compared to the royal family, and being thrown into like the deepest possible end imaginable, like all this insane protocol and like 32 forks and the Balmoral test and everything else.
Yeah, yeah.
And I feel like there's something very relatable about the fact that, you know, she, it basically triggered, or what we think happened is that it triggered her eating disorder. It triggered quite deep depression. It triggered all kinds of other, you know, there's all this speculation online of like what mental disorder she may or may not have had. it's clear that she was having real struggles, but those struggles, I mean, just hearing about what it was like for her and the insane world that she went into, it's impossible not to be like, well, yeah, like I would go nuts in that situation too.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
I feel like what a lot of people don't seem to know is that Diana had a pretty rocky childhood, and I'm including myself in that. Her parents were very emotionally detached, and she wasn't raised with a lot of affection. How do you think that affected her expectations for her marriage to Charles?
I just think she didn't know on any level what she was getting into. Mm. I think she did the thing that a lot of us do, where it's like you meet a guy and he's nice and you kind of paper over the other stuff. You're like, oh, his family seems a little weird and like he has this weird job, I guess. But like, whatever, he's cute and he's rich and it's this fairy tale. Like, all of the information is in front of you, but you don't draw the sort of obvious conclusions from it, or you don't really think through the implications. I think one of the central themes of the royal family in like real life and in The Crown is that like they don't know how deeply weird they are and how absurd their entire situation is. Like, we're bringing somebody into this insane, like, protocol dense, rule-bound society, but we're never gonna like sit them down and be like, look, we are bananas and you need to know the parameters of our bananasness. Like, I'm gonna walk you through it. Here's like who you curtsy to first, and here's like how all these rules work, and here's the chairs you're not allowed to sit in. Like, they never really did that. And so I think Diana very understandably was just sort of charmed by this like handsome, charming guy and this kind of weird family, and just didn't think like, oh, this is my job for the rest of my life. And I cannot escape this family. Like, it is a constitutional crisis if I try to get divorced and leave this family, much less with kids, which of course provides this entire other level of complexity. So I don't think any of us would have understood what was really involved in joining the royal family at age 19.
Yeah. So young.
Oh my gosh. So you just mentioned their ages. They got married when Diana was just 20 and Charles was 32. How much of that do you think factored into their problems in their relationship?
So much. I mean, she was a young 19 and he was an old 32.
Yeah.
That one of the most interesting things about his childhood is the fact that he really didn't get along with any kids his own age. Mm-hmm. And he was bullied at school, which is always really interesting to me because you'd think all the kids would want to be his friend. But it sounds like he was really ostracized by other kids his age. So for most of his life, he spent it A, preparing to be king, and B, hanging out with a bunch of old people. So I don't know what the cultural references would have been at that time, but I imagine hanging out with somebody who's 32 now and is like really into like Perry Como and like Frank Sinatra and like Clark Gable. All of his cultural references are like the cultural references of old people.
Right.
And then you've got Diana, who is, 20 when they get married. You know, she was a high school dropout. She had never really lived on her own. You know, her parents bought her an apartment in Kensington. She had some sort of odd jobs, but she had never been financially independent. She had never really had an adult life. So she's also just super shuttered and like kind of traumatized by her like weird, cold childhood.
Yeah.
And then, you know, really the only thing they had in common was the fact that they both had these like parallel crappy childhoods.
Well, then, do you think there was ever a universe in which Charles and Diana could have worked? I mean, they both desperately wanted affection and validation. Could they have salvaged their marriage if they communicated better, or were they always doomed?
I think they could have done it. I think the problem was they're in like this sort of weird generational liminal space between an arranged marriage and a love match.
Mm-hmm.
Because like there's aspects of an arranged marriage, obviously, but then there's also aspects of a romantic relationship. And they could never quite figure out like where they were on that spectrum. And the central problem to me seems to be that they were very different, but they never like leaned into their differences. So, you know, Charles was never particularly good in front of cameras. He wasn't a particularly charismatic speaker. He wasn't great at, you know, visiting hospices or visiting homeless shelters. And she was great at that.
Yeah.
But instead of being like, honey, you're good at this. I'm good at the behind the scenes stuff. I'm good at raising money from like odious billionaires. So like, why don't you go to the homeless shelters and like, I will go raise money for the homeless shelters behind the scenes. So like, you have your thing and I have my thing. And then we team up and then we sort of reach our mutual goals. But neither one of them were mature enough to do that. Like, she thought that he was really lame for not being able to do that stuff. And he thought that she was really frivolous and ridiculous for like, why are you wearing outfits and stuff? So they weren't mature enough to see like, this isn't really a romantic match, but we can make the marriage work by just like parenting together. That was one of the only things that they did well together. And also just like having separate spheres. But I mean, I do think that it was doomed in the sense that like it never would have been a love match. Like they never would have been in a functioning romantic relationship, but they could have been in like a reasonably decent professional relationship, which is what a lot of those royal marriages are,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I don't know. It sounds like if You're Wrong About ever doesn't keep going, you could make it as a couples consultant. I mean, I just want, because you're right, because so much of like relationships can be like partnerships, and there were a lot of missed opportunities there for sure.
I also think, I mean, pop culture gives us so few examples of like mature conflict resolution.
Yes.
And like, you know, because conflict, like, you know, what we see in like Real Housewives or like any fictionalized portrayal of relationships, it's like this bananas reality show contestant behavior where just everything escalates.
Yeah.
Because mature conflict resolution is super boring. It's like, I feel hurt when you say this. Oh, I'm sorry, sweetie. I didn't know.
So we're not supposed to scream and throw drinks? Is that exactly what you're trying to tell me? Because I didn't get that message.
Okay. I always think about the Real Housewives thing where she's like, you beast. Like, that's not how it's supposed to work.
Right.
Okay, so I want to talk about Charles and Camilla for a second. In particular, Tampon Gate. Can you explain to our listeners what that was? I was not a fan. So gross.
I mean, I feel so bad for them. At the point where this phone call, this salacious phone call, quote unquote salacious phone call, was surreptitiously recorded, they had been, you know, having an affair off and on for like 15 years at that point. They were very comfortable with each other. And I don't think any couple who has been together that long, I don't think any of their dirty talk or even small talk would like hold up if it was subjected to this level of scrutiny. Like, I'm 100% sure if you recorded me and my boyfriend talking on the phone, like any conversation, we would say just ridiculous shit to each other because you have like a sort of shared common language.
Sure.
And so, you know, that conversation, it's a long conversation. A lot of it is sexual logistics. It's like, whose house can we have sex in this weekend? Right. What about David? What about Lori? And so that stuff is mostly boring. So that always gets cut out of the transcript. And there's this brief period where they're like, it's hard to think about them being like hot and heavy. Like, that's obviously the wrong term.
Yeah.
But they're talking, you know, in this sort of sexual logistics, it's sort of like, I miss you too. And like, as it does, it sort of escalates.
Of course.
And at one point he says, you know, if I just lived in your panties, this would be so much easier. And then she's like, LOL, like a tampon. He's like, you betcha, you know? And I thought it was kind of cute. I don't know. I mean,
yeah,
there's this thing I feel like people see other people's like dirty talk and we sort of pretend to be shocked by it.
Yeah.
But it's like, I've had dirtier conversations than that. I think a lot of people have had dirtier conversations than that. And so I just feel like I can't talk shit on their dirty talk lest somebody talk shit on mine in case one of mine ever leaks. I'm just going to be magnanimous about this just in case.
Can you just give us an example of one of yours so we know? No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, we got to compare to know for sure.
Yeah, I have the transcript next to me. Hang on.
Perfect.
Perfect. We'll reenact it like we did on Even the Rich.
Oh, they love
that. But you're basically saying this talk was actually an example of mature conflict resolution.
I mean, it kind of is. And it's an example of like what Charles really wasn't getting at home, which is not the sex stuff, but just like someone who likes him and someone who he likes. Like, they're teasing each other. At one point, Camilla is saying like, oh, you're going to deliver a speech tomorrow. I can't wait to read it. Like, you know, do you mind sending me the transcript of the last speech that you gave? And that's something, you know, one of Diana's real faults was that she never like nourished Charles's intellectual hobbies.
Yeah.
And he was someone who I think wrongly considers himself an intellectual, but like that is something that's really important to him. And part of being in a relationship is like finding out what other people are passionate about and like giving them what they want. Yeah. You know, like you're someone who thinks that you're giving really good TED Talks. And like, you know, a lot of your TED Talks are like bordering on ecofascism and like overpopulation and all this bullshit. But also like, we're in a relationship. And sometimes you just got to be like, that was a great speech, honey. I don't think he ever got that. And, you know, Diana never got that either. Like, neither one of them were capable of recognizing what the other was good at. And that's so toxic to a relationship.
Yeah. Really,
you got to know your love language, you know?
Yeah.
It's important. Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank?
Literally always.
Okay, well, the new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look and it comes in luxe gold packaging. It feels incredibly high-end, but it is a lot more affordable.
Oh yeah, the Panorama Mascara lives up to its name by giving your lashes panoramic volume and a fully fanned out look. Its tapered mascara wand catches every single lash, including those hard-to-reach corner lashes. When I do wear makeup, I do the bare minimum, and that's usually eyeliner and mascara and lip gloss. Yeah. And so mascara has to really pop.
Yes.
And let me tell you, L'Oreal, this baby pops.
Yeah. I do love the packaging. Like, I'm all about that.
So if you're looking for an affordable mascara that gives you voluminous, lengthened lashes, you can buy the Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
So as a listener of Even the Rich, you know that audio piques the imagination, which is why we're so excited for Audible's new collection of exclusive thrillers. They feature captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances that really bring the story to life.
Oh, yeah. The next listen on my list is the psychological thriller, The Silent Patient.
Ooh.
So it's all about a therapist who tries to unravel the mystery of a woman who refuses to talk or give any explanation as to why she shot her husband. I mean, it's going to be the perfect binge listen, and you know I love my thrillers.
I can agree. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog.
Yeah, new members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/eventherich or text eventherich to 500-500.
That's audible.com/eventherich or text eventherich to 500-500 to get started. Now, a lot of us have lifetime movie associations with the idea of royalty. We think glamour and we think fairy tale. But as you say on You're Wrong About, you look at royalty and you think human rights abuse. Tell us what you mean by that.
Part of this is my own stuff because I worked in human rights for 11 years. So like, yeah. I'm definitely coming to this with my own personal baggage. And I also think, because people have like yelled at us in like my email inbox since this happened, they're like, there's other reasons for the royal family to be abolished. And like, yes, like we all know the debates. We all know the reasons. Like there are many, you know, these people are not democratically elected, blah, blah, blah. We all know the reasons officially why the royal family should be abolished. And I agree with most of them. But also, I think it's just worth noting that this is totally indefensible on a personal level, that none of these people have any choice in what they do in their lives. Like, if it was any other family that was being raised and the government just said, like, no, no, this is your job. You have no freedom of movement. You have no freedom to choose your role. Mm. You have no freedom to quit your job ever. You have to do this for us. Like, we wouldn't accept that. Right.
Yeah.
It's really only the money and the privilege that makes that acceptable. And again, I think there's this like performative naivete where we're like, oh, how could they possibly be sad with a lot of money?
Right.
It's like, do you know anyone with money? Like, money doesn't make people happy.
Yeah.
Like, again, there are other and better reasons to get rid of the royal family, but it's also just, it's totally indefensible as a thing to do to people. Like, none of them can do anything else with their lives, and they're all really miserable.
So in our series, we talked about Meghan's emotional ITV interview where she admitted it was really hard to be in the royal limelight. Diana herself seemed to have a very love-hate relationship with the press. Michael, can you speak to how much the limelight made her life difficult, but also allowed her some measure of control over her situation?
I don't think any of us truly understand what it's like to have literally up to 40 photographers following you everywhere. Right?
Yeah.
And to the extent where, you know, we all have sort of hardships in our life, but you get the sense of like you can kind of take a break from them or you can go in your house and be away from them. Like Diana literally couldn't go anywhere or do anything in public ever without this phalanx of journalists following her around. And a hugely, I think, debilitating thing for her was the fact that she couldn't trust anybody around her. Like at one point, her therapist sells her story to the tabloids.
Oh my God.
Wow.
So like, can you imagine someone as
oh my gosh,
to a therapist that all of a sudden it's like, oh, the things that I told my therapist are now in the goddamn newspaper.
Oh, that's awful.
I mean, that, you know, we talk a lot about how Diana was really paranoid and Diana didn't trust anybody and she had this idea that people were spying on her. And it's like, yeah, they objectively were. Like, her phone was bugged and like people were literally following her and people were literally selling her secrets. You know, if she was crying or she was having a bad day or she was walking around the palace in sweats or whatever. Imagine if like your worst habits showed up in the newspaper and the entire country was talking about them a couple of days later. So like, yeah, of course she was paranoid.
Yeah.
She had a lot to be paranoid about.
Wow.
So on that note, Something we weren't able to cover about Diana's story was her panorama interview with Martin Bashir, which only happened because he lied to her. Can you fill us in on what happened to get her on camera? Some of our listeners probably don't know the full story
of that.
You know, Martin Bashir, this journalist who was like kind of a nobody at the time, he got in touch with Diana, I believe through a mutual friend or like his cousin or something. Somehow he got in touch with her and he worked on her for months trying to convince her to do this interview. And one of the things he did, and the BBC has admitted this, that they got one of the graphic designers at the BBC to forge a check to make it look like one of Diana's employees had been selling her secrets to the tabloids.
Wow.
And this was a real, like, as I mentioned, this was a real thing that happened. And so Bashir told her, I believe that it was like one of my contacts at MI6, like one of my national security contacts, which he did not have. Like, that was a total lie. And, you know, I mean, he was playing on her paranoia, right?
Yeah.
He was exploiting something, you know, a very real fear of hers. And like, as a journalist, like, I've done things to get people to agree to interviews, but like, I've never done that. Like, just straight up lying to somebody to get them to do an interview is like really bad.
Yeah.
And the BBC had an inquest originally about this, I believe in 1996 or sometime reasonably short after the interview. And they determined that he had forged the checks, but they hadn't affected her decision to do the interview.
Oh.
Which I think doesn't absolve him of moral responsibility. At all. Like, I broke into your house, but I didn't steal anything.
Yeah.
Like, no, it's still bad to break into somebody's house. Like,
right.
This is not that difficult.
Do you think that Diana would be remembered as fondly now if that interview hadn't happened?
I mean, that interview was a nuclear bomb in British culture. I mean, you know, for a lot of people, they talk about it as the first time they had ever heard her speak, right? Because she was always this distant figure. She was always, you know, she's on the cover of magazines. She always looks so amazing, right? She's so radiant and she's always in this designer stuff. It was the first time that she just talks about herself in this ordinary way. And she talks about her relationship in a way that a lot of us can relate to. And she talked about her bulimia and she talked about her suicide attempts in like a really moving way. And, you know, they talk about how diagnoses of bulimia in the UK spiked hugely after she started talking about it. And, you know, I've done work on eating disorders for various articles over the years. And one of the most sort of affecting things when you have an eating disorder is finding out that you're not alone and finding out that what you're going through, like what you thought was this deep, dark secret, is actually a pretty standard component of an illness that other people have, and you can start to talk to people about it. And a lot of people really saw themselves and saw their struggles in Diana, and it humanized her. And it's also very interesting that it had exactly the opposite effect on the royal family, because they have these absurd, like, you know, 15th century social mores about, you know, you're never supposed to reveal anything about yourself to the public. And they're like, oh, this mortifying woman speaking about her struggles. And of course, that's what everybody likes about her, is that she's human.
Right.
And that's what the royal family hates about her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so this to them was like the last straw, like, oh, let's get this woman out of our lives. Like, she's this nutcase who's talking about mental illness on the airwaves. That to me perfectly illustrates the break between the understanding of the royal family that the public had versus the understanding of the royal family that the royal family has. Like, they have the completely wrong idea about their own jobs.
Right.
Also, can I give you guys a fun fact?
Yes, please do.
Because, you know, her, like, her makeup in that interview is iconic, right? Like, this is what everybody talks about, this, like, very smoky black eyeshadow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it was done under such a veil of secrecy, her press team didn't even know about it. The palace didn't know about it. The BBC hid it from their own board of directors because they were so afraid that the royal family would find out and kill it. She did her own makeup. So, like, that look, that's like a Diana look, which I always think is fun.
I love that.
That is really fun.
Speaking of Diana looking amazing, which we know she was an icon, we didn't get to talk about this too much on our show. We teased about it a little bit, but we were fascinated by the story of Diana's revenge dress.
Yes.
Why was this little black dress such a huge deal? Can you just tell us why it was such a media sensation at the time?
I mean, part of it is just like she looks amazing.
Yeah.
Let's
be clear. Yes.
She looks great. It's just like a knockout outfit. And I mean, part of it was, you know, it's this encapsulation of how she became much better at dealing with the media throughout the course of her life, that she wore this to a art gallery opening on the night that Prince Charles was starring in a BBC documentary about himself.
Right.
And he had spent 18 months working with the BBC, and they followed him hunting, and he was like doing his little TED Talk shtick. And he thought, like, man, I'm really going to endear myself to the British public. Like, this is my big coming out. And then Diana originally wasn't going to attend this event, but when she found out that this BBC documentary was airing, she's like, oh, fuck this, I'm going. And yeah. So she puts on this like banger of a dress and she shows up, and all she does is like get out of the car, shake some hands. Like, she doesn't really do anything. But then Prince Charles gets the newspaper the following day, and what's on the cover? Not him, Diana. She yeah. deliberately did this to take the spotlight off of him. And he's like, oh, I'm finally going to like be this like special person for the British public. And she's like, look at these shoulders. And no one cared about Charles.
Oh, man. Petty Diana is my favorite Diana.
Seriously.
Love. So, inspirational.
I mean, yeah, the dress itself, I mean, I don't actually know that much about fashion. I think yeah. it just like looks great.
Yeah.
And I think she hadn't appeared in public for a while. I think it's less about the actual dress and more about, you know, her going to this mm-hmm. opening, and she hadn't done very many public events that year. But all I know is that the dress looks amazing.
Agreed. So do you think Diana changed what we expect from royalty? Did she force future royals to become celebrities?
I think it's interesting because in some ways she profoundly delegitimized the royal family, because everybody could see how terrible they were to her and how terribly they reacted to her death and how sort of cold and obsessed with protocol, etc. But on the other hand, she was a member of the royal family and she was really popular. And so in some ways that ends up entrenching the royal family, and it actually makes it harder to get rid of the royal family, because you're like, hey, some of them are cool. And so I don't know how much of that sort of bounced off and ended up improving the standing of the royal family generally. I mean, I think she changed the nature of celebrity, or she was emblematic of a change, that what people want now is authenticity. People want messiness on some level. You know, we want people to express who they are. We want people to be themselves. And that was something the royal family never really got. But I do think that like the next generation of the royal family does get that on some level.
Michael, you mentioned that a lot of people were really upset about how the royal family didn't really speak out after her death. Can you talk mm-hmm. a bit more about the public backlash about that?
Well, so after she died, they basically didn't say anything for days. Their perspective on it was always like, well, she's not a member of the royal family. You know, she divorced from Charles at that point. They've been divorced for like 15 months or 14 months at that point. And so they were like, well, you know, she's out of the royal family. She doesn't have her title. There was this entire long bullshit thing about the title. And it's like, well, it's this lady who was nice, but like, I don't see why, you know, we should make an official statement. And sort of in their defense, some of the backlash against them was ginned up by the tabloids. Because after Diana died in the car crash, there was a lot of hatred of the tabloids, because the narrative was like the paparazzi killed her.
Right?
Like they're chasing her on their motorcycles and they drove the car into the pole, which isn't really true, but that was the narrative that was forming. And the tabloids wanted to deflect attention. So they made this big deal about like the flag on Buckingham Palace wasn't flying at half mast, even though that's not a flag that flies. Like it had never even flown the British flag. It's like a dumb royal protocol flag. And also the royal family really wanted to protect William and Harry. So part of the reason that they were out of public life was William and Harry had just lost their mother, and they wanted to sort of keep them up in Scotland and really take care of them and really focus on themselves as a family. They were being human in that moment on some level. On the other hand, she was a member of the royal family. Like,
yeah.
Do you know who your job is? Like, sorry, you need to give a decent human statement
yeah.
on, like, this woman who's the mother of the heir to the throne
right.
fucking died, and we should say, like, that's bad.
Yeah.
And, like, we're sad that she died. It's not that hard.
Right.
And so, on some level, like, some of the criticism was overblown, but also, like, come on. Like,
right.
give a speech. This is
yeah.
what you do.
Seriously. Now, I know you said that you didn't get into Harry and Meghan too much, but we have to ask, do you think Diana's influence is part of the reason that they're so popular?
Probably. I don't know. That's a good question. I haven't thought about it. I think that they're just of a generation. I mean, first of all, Diana and Charles actually really did their best to give William and Harry like semi-normal childhoods. They didn't want them to have these cold and distant, like dad eats in a different room every night childhoods, like for no reason. Like, they wanted to give them as normal of a childhood as they could and keep them in touch. And, you know, famously, Diana brought William and Harry with her when she visited AIDS hospices and homeless shelters. And she tried to drill into them that, like, sometimes people are down on their luck and it doesn't mean anything about their character. They had a bad day and we need to provide them help when they have a bad day. So some of that probably rubbed off. And then there's just the generational thing that, you know, the mores around power, political power, royalty, etc., they've just changed so much. And so somehow that must have trickled down to William and Harry somehow, just people don't want to have these super formal relationships to people in power anymore.
Okay, so we have to talk about the crown, of course.
We have to.
Oh my God.
So after the latest season of The Crown premiered, the UK's culture minister called on Netflix to explicitly label the show as fiction. We definitely rolled our eyes at that because obviously I mean, Prince Charles is not that cute in real life.
Yeah.
But after your research into the family, do you think enough of the story was changed to warrant a disclaimer? Like, is it enough to be spiritually true, even if it's not historically true?
I don't know. It's weird because the show fabricates a ton of factual stuff.
Yeah.
They made up this whole arc where Diana and Charles go to Australia on this sort of official 6-week mission. Mm-hmm. And they fabricate this thing where, like, at the beginning of the trip, she's bad with the press and she gives this disastrous press conference. Mm-hmm. And then over the 6 weeks, she learns and she grows. And by the end, she's good with the press. And it's like, no, she was kind of always good with the press. And like, if that arc happened, it happened over the course of like years. But what's interesting about it is in a lot of these arcs, they fabricate these arcs for Diana where like they end up at the right place. Mm. Right? Like that episode ends with her, like she's good at the press and Charles resents her. And like, that's true. It's just all the stuff about her, like fucking up her lines and like crying from the press. All that stuff's fake. I think some of that is done on a various spectrum of responsible versus irresponsible. But in general, if you watch the show, if you watch the whole season, I think you'd get like a pretty true idea of what actually happened. And especially I think a true idea of who these people are. You can argue that that's on some level responsibly if you get to the right destination, even if you're fabricating the way they got there. I mean, I think it's a mix, honestly. It would be so weird to add the disclaimer to it. I don't know. It just seems like people sort of know that it's a TV show.
It's Hollywood.
Also, aren't we all watching that show with fucking Wikipedia on our phones in our hands?
Right.
This is what I was doing for earlier seasons, because I didn't do any research on sort of the royal family in the 60s. And I was watching season 3, like second screening the whole time, like, oh, mining disaster in Wales. When did that really happen? What really happened when the queen went there? It's like, we're all doing this. I don't know if we really need to be debunking this.
Yeah.
People are like self-debunking it as we're watching.
I go down so many rabbit holes. Like, I go on, like, Wikipedia to look up something, and the next thing you know, it's like, Ben, I've missed 2 episodes because I'm still looking things up.
So you're like, how hard are diamonds?
I know.
There's nothing to do with anything.
Truly.
Oh, man.
So then, do you have a favorite moment or episode from this season?
I loved the episode where she's roller skating around Buckingham Palace. I mean, that's another episode where they fabricated stuff. That, you know, they fabricated this whole thing where she moves into Buckingham Palace and then immediately Charles fucks off to Australia. And then he basically gets back like the night before their wedding. And so for their, you know, according to the show, for basically their entire engagement, he was absent. But their engagement was 5 months long and he was in Australia for, I think, 4 weeks. And the lunch between her and Camilla was great. That episode to me is very interesting because you're basically watching somebody who's like sort of depicted as normal and sunny and has this crush on this prince that she just met, and you're just watching that sour and like turn to poison over the course of that one episode where she realizes kind of what she's gotten herself into. That's a journey we've all been through in relationships, and that's a journey we've all been through with people where you're like, oh, this person sucks. You eventually realize it. Most of us aren't roller skating through Buckingham Palace.
No.
But that, like, I just thought that episode and that experience of hers is like super relatable.
So it's been nearly 30 years since Diana became a princess, and it's been more than 20 years since her death. So we want to end on this question. Why do we still find her so fascinating?
The cynic in me wants to say, like, she's a hot white lady, you know? Like, part of it, you know, some of the worship of Princess Diana, I think, goes overboard, where it's just like, yeah, she wore nice outfits, and she's, like, a wealthy white lady, and that's about it. I think a lot of that sort of surface level stuff, that's basically what it is. I think on a deeper level, I think it's a fish out of water story. It has like dark, but it has like romantic comedy elements of this, you know, semi-normal person who goes into this completely abnormal situation and it changes her and she changes them and eventually she escapes. And then she has this sort of this tragic death, but this tragic death that doesn't really, you know, it's not like Marilyn Monroe or something where she ends up killing herself or something where it's like, you know, every death obviously is tragic, but like it's just kind of like this random freak event that happens that ends up killing her.
Yeah.
And so you can almost tell it as like a happy story. And obviously she died too soon. On some level, that makes it easier to celebrate, I think. And also, she was a hot white lady with like great shoulders, great dresses. What do you guys think it is?
I don't know that I ever had this fantasy, but there's a common fantasy of like little girls wanting to become princesses. Mm. And so to have a princess basically take the shine off of it, it's just like, oh shit, this is kind of cool to see that it's not as glamorous as we've all made it out to be in our heads. And I think there's some kind of obsession with that, just real people being real and human.
Yeah.
Right. It's the contrast between what's on the surface and then what's underneath.
Yes.
It. I think those stories are always really compelling.
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, all of us want a distraction from this.
I know.
I mean, that's also like, give me some rich white ladies and cool outfits, man. Like on some level, I think talking about a princess in the middle of the year we've just had, I think a lot of people really want
that
right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Life is busier than ever. It might be harder to find time these days to grocery shop, prep, and cook healthy and hearty meals. I get it. But Factor's got you covered.
Yeah, so Factor's fresh, never frozen meals are chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, delivered right to your door, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes.
Exactly. And Factor is tailored to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with the flexibility to get as much or as little as you need. If you're traveling or still finishing up last week's meals, you can always pause or reschedule deliveries.
I mean, I know I've talked before about how much I love Factor because it's just so easy.
And it doesn't taste like, you know, the microwavable meals you see, especially in rom-coms when we're trying to heighten and highlight how sad and pathetic this woman's life is.
Yeah.
They don't taste like that. They taste so good as if you made them yourself or hired a chef. Head to factormeals.com/rich50 and use code rich50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code rich50 at factormeals.com/rich50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
We all face stress in our daily lives. What if the answer to a better stress response is in one key nutrient? I'm talking about magnesium, and specifically Magnesium Breakthrough by Optimizers. This one-of-a-kind product is designed to reverse low levels of magnesium, which could have a positive effect on our stress response. But don't take my word for it. Here's a quote from a 2020 issue of the scientific journal Nutrients. Results suggest that stress could increase magnesium loss, causing a deficiency. And in turn, magnesium deficiency could enhance the body's susceptibility to stress, resulting in a magnesium and stress vicious circle. I only recommend Magnesium Breakthrough by Optimizers. It's the only organic full-spectrum magnesium supplement that includes 7 unique forms of magnesium for stress resilience and better sleep. Simply go to bioptimizers.com/ifstories, promo code ifstories10 to get your Magnesium Breakthrough and find out this month's gift with purchase. That's bioptimizers.com/ifstories, promo code ifstories10.
So, Michael, for our last segment, we're going to try something new and hopefully very fun.
Yeah. Congratulations. You're our guinea pig.
Are we going to play Twister? How are we going to do this?
Oh, my gosh. Can we play virtual Twister? That would be so fun.
I mean, we are going to take it back to middle school.
Oh, no.
Here. No. So we're going to do a Would You Rather royalty edition. Okay. So I'm going to ask you both some easy questions, and all you have to do is make your choice and then just defend your answer to the death.
All we have to do, okay. She says.
That's all you got to
so
do.
So easy.
Okay. So, all right. First one. Would you rather marry the heir or the spare?
Do you want to go first?
Definitely the spare. You're still getting the royal treatment and you're getting those bonuses, but you're not actually going to have to be leading a country and dealing with all the shit that they deal with.
Okay. When I was a kid, you know how like kids fantasize about like being actors and models and stuff like that? When I was a kid, I fantasized about being a writer who wrote novelizations of existing movies. Like that was my deepest fantasy. So for me, the answer is always whichever thing puts me out of the public spotlight the most.
Okay.
Whichever role doesn't have to ever give a press conference or be in front of a camera in any or like have any responsibilities at all. So I think that puts me for the spare category, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
I love that you say that as someone who hosts a very popular podcast.
Well, no one can see me. This is why I make me comfortable.
That's true. Okay.
I don't want to be seen. Yes. If I can rule Britannia without being seen, then okay. The heir, absolutely.
That's yes. Fair. Okay, next one. Would you rather be raised by Prince Charles or Prince Philip?
I feel like this is actually easy.
Do you?
That's
okay.
So easy, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Should we say at the same time?
Okay, yeah. Okay, 3, 2, 1,
Prince Charles. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Oh my God.
I agree.
That's
with
like
you guys.
The easiest because he would be so manipulable.
Exactly.
He's so sensitive.
I mean, it's easy to get away with stuff.
Yeah,
right?
He'll be hunting all the time. So I mean,
exactly.
I can do whatever the fuck I want.
And you're like, Dad, can I stay up late? And he's like, No. And you're like, but I love ecofascism. And he's like, okay.
Oh, man. Okay. Next one. Would you rather do laughing gas with Prince Harry or drink Zazas with the Queen?
Oh man. Okay.
Ooh.
I want to do Zazas with the Queen. I want to get her drunk.
Yeah. I know. Wouldn't she be fun to see drunk?
Yes.
Sure. I would just want to get hammered and talk about corgis.
Yes. Yeah. Oh man.
I would also quiz her on like European capitals. I think that would be fun too.
I feel like she'd
be like, Dubrovnik, go.
Okay. Next one. Would you rather take a camping trip to Botswana or do a summer regatta on the royal yacht Britannia?
Botswana.
I'm
easy.
So bougie.
Easy.
I'm saying Britannia.
I was going to say Arisha's not going camping.
Oh, man. Are you a camper? You like to camp?
I mean, I haven't been to Botswana, but I like that part of Africa.
Okay.
And I like safaris. And the idea, honestly, of like being trapped somewhere with these people is like, I get, it's like looking at the girl from The Ring. It's like, that's my, like, cold chills go down my spine. The idea of being trapped with these like etiquette obsessed weirdos in like an enclosed space, absolutely not.
Mm. Okay. Would you rather binge all of Suits or all of The Crown?
I guess I'd say Suits only because it's fun and fake, which is nice.
Yes. Have you guys noticed a thing? I get exhausted when I watch The Crown because the episodes feel longer than they are.
Yes,
a lot of times.
They do.
Yeah.
It's not bingeable to me. We had like a one episode per day limit in the Hobbs household when we were watching it. So it's like, oh, I don't know if I can do another one of these.
So does that mean you choose Suits?
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. This is the final one. Would you rather make the royal family more emotionally intelligent or abolish the monarchy altogether?
I'm going to let you go first because mine's really obvious.
Yeah, get rid of the monarchy. I mean, come on.
Yeah,
it's 2020.
Smash it. Me and Sarah had a whole thing that we didn't include in the episode. We cut it for time. But this thing about how the monarchy is basically like the metric system. Everyone agrees that having the metric system is better. And like everyone agrees that abolishing the monarchy is better. But also the process of switching to the metric system sounds like a fucking nightmare.
Yeah.
Like, how would you do it? And you have to change all the like rulers, and there'd be like old people who don't know it, and young people who, like the transition would be a nightmare.
Right.
So like the can keeps getting kicked down the road because no politician wants to like spend all their political capital on like changing to kilometers or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing with the monarchy. Like, we all know it would be better if Britain just like did the democracy thing like every other country. Mm-hmm. Like, just don't have these random people in charge of your country. But it would be like a pretty big deal.
Yeah.
Like, in process of getting rid of it, there's like weird financial implications, there's constitutional implications. Like, things would come up in that process that like I think a lot of people just like don't want to touch, and it's easier to just leave it in place even though it's like totally indefensible.
That's a great analogy too.
Yeah, really, it's like, oh, screw it, it's too hard.
Yeah, exactly. And like there's other problems in Britain right now, and they're like, yeah, we'll everyone's just like, we'll abolish the monarchy tomorrow, and they've been doing that for like 40 years.
Yeah. All right, well, that was it, Michael. Thank you for playing along, and we have an honorary title for you.
Oh no.
I hereby pronounce you His Royal Highness Doyen of Even the Rich.
Congratulations.
I can't be a duke? Come on.
Okay, well, we can make you a duke.
But thank you so much. This was
Michael, this was
a
great.
Lot of fun.
This is fun. Thank you for letting me rant about Diana.
Yeah,
this is what I'm like to hang out with for normal people. Just ask me about Diana, get like a 6-minute answer.
No, we love
it. I'm not upset about it. I love it. Thanks again to Michael Hobbs.
Oh my God, how amazing is he?
So amazing.
He's our new best friend. Okay. So, Arisha, we are so close to the holidays. Aren't you excited?
Yeah. The only person who loves Christmas more than me is Mariah Carey.
Yeah, well, things are going to look a little different for a lot of people this season, but we couldn't possibly let the year pass us by without checking in on our super rich imaginary besties.
Oh my God, does this mean what I think it means?
You betcha.
Holiday special!
That's right. Next week, for our very last episode of the year, we're going to bring you a little holiday magic, even the rich style. We might not be able to see your beautiful faces, but it doesn't mean we can't have some fun. We'll have a special guest, maybe two, a little trivia, and some other fun things you're going to love.
I might actually be trembling with anticipation.
Yeah, same.
I'm Arisha Skidmore-Williams.
And I'm Brooke Sifrin. This episode was produced by Caleb Bissinger, Natalie Shisha, and Kate Young. Our interview producer is Michelle Lanz. Our audio engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Our executive producers are Stephanie Jens, Marshall Louis, and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.